From NPR News, this is Foreign Dispatch, a weekly roundup of some of the best coverage of news and events filed by NPR's correspondents from around the globe. I'm Ted Clark. This week, in Burma, a Buddhist monk is suspected of encouraging attacks against Muslims. Artists and performers try to revitalize downtown Cairo, and natural gas is less of a U.S. import now and more of an export. Here's a pattern we've seen in several countries in recent years. An authoritarian regime is pushed aside in the name of democracy. But sometimes, along with that democracy, comes ethnic and sectarian tensions. The latest example of this? Myanmar, also known as Burma, where Buddhist nationalism is on the rise. NPR's Anthony Kuhn profiles a Burmese monk accused of being the spiritual leader behind a wave of nationalism and anti-Muslim sentiment.
In March, more than 40 people were killed in fighting between Buddhists and Muslims in the central Burmese town of Maitila. From amateur videos on the internet like this one, it's clear that some Buddhist monks joined in the violence. Some monks were victims of the fighting, others tried to stop it. But some people say that one monk in particular was behind it. He's the abbot of this monastery in Myanmar's second city, Mandalay. 45-year-old U Wiratu is considered a talented scholar of Buddhist scriptures in the ancient Pali language, and that gives him authority among Buddhists. He's dressed in saffron-colored robes. Wiratu says he was in Maitila during the violence and was trying to stop it.
We spoke to the crowds to try to control the situation. We assured them of their safety. We told them we intended to protect their lives and homes and ask them to join us.
Wiratu admits he's a Buddhist nationalist, but he says he's just defending his nation and his religion.
The Burmese race has been insulted. The Buddhist religion has been attacked, and our country has been trespassed. These are the origins of our nationalism.
Wiratu says that the recent violence in Maitila is the result of fighting between Muslims and Buddhists last year in western Rakhine State that killed more than 110 people. The group Human Rights Watch has called this ethnic cleansing against Muslims, but Wiratu says it was an organized attack on Buddhism. Wiratu says he's not anti-Muslim, he's just against Buddhists marrying and doing business with Muslims.
Muslims who live in Burma have raped Burmese girls, even mute girls, mad girls, Buddhist nuns too. They married Burmese Buddhist girls and forced them to convert to Islam by stepping on the pictures of the Buddha and pagodas. All this inflicted a lot of mental pain.
Under Britain's colonial rule of Burma, many Muslim Indians dominated professions such as medicine and money lending. Some economic resentment from that period lingers on. Perhaps the most contradictory thing about U Wiratu is that he and his followers describe him as pro-democratic. Pictures of democracy icon Aung San Suu Kyi meeting with President Obama are prominently displayed in his monastery. Matt Walton is a Burma expert at George Washington University. He says that a century ago, Buddhist nationalists like U Wiratu led the effort to make Burma into a modern democracy free of British colonial rule.
You had this really complex combination of democratic intentions, or at that time, a desire for independence, that was coupled often with this virulent exclusionary nationalism, this idea that in order to get our independence, we had to get rid of all of these other groups that weren't really part of the nation.
Walton says that in Burma, the concept of democracy often emphasizes the rule of the majority, which in this case means ethnic Burman and Buddhist. Buddhist nationalism has also cropped up in Sri Lanka, where majority Buddhists are in conflict with Hindu and Christian Tamils, and in southern Thailand, where there are tensions with Malay Muslims. A decade ago, authorities charged U Wiratu with inciting anti-Muslim riots outside Mandalay, and they jailed him for 8 years. He's aware that it could happen this time, too.
One of my followers was arrested. Another one is missing, and his house was searched. Some of the books of mine were confiscated. They are watching me, too, and probably will arrest me soon.
He points to two men who have quietly come in and sat down during our interview. One, he says, is police, and the other, military intelligence. Anthony Kuhn, NPR News.
Five years ago, a massive earthquake killed almost 90,000 people in China's Sichuan province. 5 years later, with the province recovering from a recent, much smaller earthquake, NPR's Louisa Lim has returned to Sichuan, and she's found allegations that the quake reconstruction effort has been plagued by corruption and wrongdoing.
Air raid sirens howl to remember around 200 people who lost their lives in the most recent earthquake in Lushan. It takes me back 5 years to the first time I heard this noise, following the massive quake that killed around 90,000 people. Then the country united to try to help the survivors. But 5 years on, the mood here has changed to one of bitter resentment and anger.
So I've now come to a brand new town, which was specially built to house the survivors of the earthquake who'd lived in Beichuan, a town that had been totally destroyed. And I have to say, from the outside, this new town looks amazing. There's row after row of six-story blocks, brand new, and I'm standing opposite a huge sports centre with a big swimming pool outside. But I have to say, underneath this impressive facade, the problems still exist.
One resident, who gives her name as Mrs. Zhou, is pointing at the cracks in the wall of her apartment. She's lived here just over 2 years. Fissures run up and down and across the walls of almost every room. Many of these residents believe their apartments are shoddily built. Tofu dregs construction, as it's called here, since the buildings are as unstable as tofu. That was the reason why so many buildings collapsed 5 years ago. Now people fear the post-quake buildings were also built too hastily and with substandard materials. Some local officials took the chance to feather their own nests, other residents say. So far, at least 11 people have been sentenced for corruption in post-quake building work. Another party official is due to stand trial, reportedly for pocketing bribes of $1.7 million. These residents don't know who's to blame. They're just worried their new homes could be structurally unsound.
So even the foundations of this six-story building don't look at all stable. At certain points, the building is kind of shearing away from the pavement, and there's this big crack running along the bottom of the building. And at some points, it's as long as one of my fingers.
The bigger irony is that Mrs. Zhou wasn't even rehoused as a quake survivor. She and her friends are part of a group of 11,000 villagers whose land was taken by the government for the new town. Most of it still lies untouched. They say it's been put up for sale at 100 times the price they were compensated for it. A farmer who represents the villagers, Li Yitian, has been put in prison for 3 years, found guilty of organising residents to create a disturbance. His son, Li Yang, says the charges are ridiculous.
They wanted to get the land so they could sell it when the price appreciated. This is robbery. It's completely naked exploitation. You want to take over my land? You should negotiate with me. But without any negotiation, they stopped our water supply and electricity. This is the way bandits behave.
The new Beichuan, 15 miles from the devastated town, is the highest profile post-quake project, costing $1.4 billion. 40,000 residents live here now. The town centre consists of large brick buildings, mostly housing tourist shops selling cheap and nasty souvenirs. There's one big problem. There are few tourists. Having lost their land, residents struggle to get by. Vendor Zhang Ming lost 5 family members, including her daughter, in the quake. But she says she's so busy just trying to survive, she hardly has time to think of the past.
Business is no good here, especially this year. In this street, almost 70% of people are losing money. This year is worse than last year. no one comes here anymore.
In the car park, a propaganda film boasts about the reconstruction effort. There's another untold story here, too. A story of unpaid salaries and exploited workers. Chen Wenfeng is in charge of a team of builders. Twice they went to take part in post-quake reconstruction, once after the Sichuan quake, and then later building an orphanage in Yushu, a Tibetan region of China. Both times, he and his team weren't properly paid for their work, and the money he spent up front on equipment was never repaid. In total, he's owed more than $170,000.
We won't go if we're asked to take part in reconstruction work again, because every time we've gone, we haven't been paid the wages we're owed and the money we spent on gear.
When he pursued his claim for building the orphanage, he was told the work had been subcontracted three times, which is against the law. He could never figure out whether any of the bigger contractors had been paid. And because he had no written contract, again in violation of the law, it's hard for him to make his case. Appeals for donations to help victims of the latest quake dominate the airwaves. But giving is down. The widespread perception of corruption is borne out by these accounts. So much of the reconstruction effort was flawed, from the building materials used to the payment of workers to government oversight to the requisitioning of land. Maybe these people have just been unlucky, but their complaints happened in different places at different times, indicating that problems are widespread. That's certainly what Huang Qi believes. He's an activist who runs a human rights website. Since NPR last met him, Huang has spent 3 years in prison for possessing state secrets. He believes that he and other activists were sent to prison to shut them up.
After they got rid of these voices of supervision, there emerged a series of new tofu dregs buildings and new corruption. They used the excuse of the big earthquake to bring new harm to the people. That is a fact.
When this most recent quake hit, he immediately set off towards the epicenter. He was detained, then turned back by police. He suspects there were things they just didn't want him to see. Criticism is clearly being stifled by force, and local officials are not just profiting from human misery, they're adding to it too. Louisa Lim, NPR News, Beijing.
Coming up, revitalizing downtown Cairo 2 years after the revolution, and the growing abundance of natural gas in the United States. The center of Cairo is now synonymous with protests and sometimes violence. Late at night, the once bustling streets are largely empty. People worry about getting mugged or caught up in a mob. But there are efforts to revitalize downtown Cairo. NPR's Leila Fadel sent this story about a recent contemporary arts festival.
The haunting voices of revolutionary female singers fill the air in this old and decrepit theater. It is a space that tells of a glorious past. Candle-shaped lights adorn the walls, and there are dusty red velvet curtains on the stage. Here, the legendary Umm Kulsum, the Arab world's most adored female singer, once sang about love and loss for packed audiences. Today, after years of sitting unused, this theater once again echoes with music. It was chosen to host the final concert in the Contemporary Arts Festival. The decision was deliberate, to breathe new life into Cairo's decrepit architecture. The audience is taken by the voice of Dina Nwedidi, an Egyptian folk singer who shot to fame after the revolution, and Emin Methlouthi, a Tunisian singer-songwriter who is known as the voice of Tunisia's revolution. As Dina sings, she is masked by fog and bubbles, and later Emin dances across the stage, strumming a guitar and singing about freedom. Probably no one notices the missing tassels on the curtains or the smell of smoke and urine in the lobby. Ahmed Al-Attar is the director of the festival.
Cairo is a city that needs a lot of dusting. It's almost like an unloved city.
Just before the show, he sits on the steps outside the theater as artists do their sound checks inside. He chose the venue to highlight Cairo's trove of theaters and hotels that languish, dusty, and unused.
It's a city that has a lot of things hidden, and because of neglect and a general feeling of apathy over the last 50 years of military rule and dictatorship and oppression and a general feeling of not valuing your own self as individuals and also as a society, so the city is abandoned.
Downtown Cairo is filled with beautiful architecture. It was built during the brief French occupation of Egypt under Napoleon. It's Parisian with an Egyptian twist. The window arcs are stunning. Delicate balconies overlook wide streets, and the area is filled with apartments with high, ornate ceilings. But now that beauty is masked by dust, the architecture lost in decay. Since the revolution that swept through Egypt, Tunisia, and beyond, the art scene has exploded. Artists are more free to express themselves publicly, and there's a willing audience searching for something new. Amal Mathlouthi plays us a song before the show called On My Mind. It's a song she wrote as an homage to Mohamed Bouazizi, the young Tunisian man who set himself on fire, an act that sparked what was called the Arab Spring.
What I see in the audiences, they feel, in a way, my music gives them some power, some hope, some strength, because there aren't so many people who sing about freedom, about human beings, about society, about problems.
Just after her set, Dina Al-Wadidi sits in the room where Umm Kulsoom once sat backstage.
I was very excited before I go because it's a different energy backstage, you know.
She says the efforts to open the theater and other venues are important because right now there is an explosion of new musicians with nowhere to play.
We have like 200 or 300 bands independent and we move in three theaters, so it's terrible. All of us have to support this festival because they're trying to open new places and old theaters.
Beyond the venues, director Ahmed Al-Attar hopes to make this festival internationally famous.
Egypt is the heart of the Arab world, culturally and intellectually and artistically. There is a revival now, and it is important that we believe in that and we start putting it back.
Inside the theater, the Tunisian singer Amal Mathlouthi wows the crowd. By the end of the night, the audience is weeping as she sings songs about continuing a struggle for freedom. Leila Fadel, NPR News, Cairo.
The remarkable growth of American energy exploration is starkly evident at a single place in Louisiana. It's the site of a liquefied natural gas terminal. Its backers once imagined this giant facility would be used to import gas from overseas. Now they imagine gas moving in the other direction. Because of the growth of gas recovery from shale drilling, many companies are now thinking about sending gas overseas. Only one company has received a license to do that in the past 30 years. NPR's Jackie Northam has our business bottom line.
I thought that was alligator laid up in there. Right,
Doug Lawson is pretty good at spotting alligators. He sees them nearly every day here around this construction site.
Yeah, he's out there trying to enjoy a little sun, warm up a little bit.
There are also brilliantly colored birds and families of wild hogs in the southern Louisiana marshland. They have a front row view of a $15 billion expansion project, which Lawson heads at the Sabine Pass Natural Gas Terminal. The sound of heavy construction equipment at the terminal can be deafening and at times almost rhythmic. This is phase one of the expansion, which will enable the facility to export U.S. natural gas worldwide. It will include two enormous refrigeration units used to cool the methane gas coming into the terminal from pipelines across the country.
What you're looking at now is the large LNG storage tanks. There are five. Each can contain 160,000 cubic meters of liquefied natural gas.
David Giles, a senior manager with Cheniere Energy, which owns the Sabine Pass terminal, says the diameter of each storage tank is as long as a football field. He says the terminal originally was built to be an import facility. That infrastructure is still in place, but not in use. Stainless steel pipes that snake over acres of land are empty. Four tugboats designed to guide huge LNG ships into the facility's deep harbor now bob along the waterfront. A crew member passes time repainting numbers on the side of the tug. The terminal was built at a time when it was widely believed there would be a deficit of natural gas here in the U.S. Sharif Suki, the CEO of Cheniere Energy, says back then it was believed Sabine Pass would be busy and profitable for many years.
And between 2005 and 2007, the company was considered the darling of Wall Street, who performed extremely well, and everybody thought they would be extremely successful in building the facility.
But Suki says by the time construction was completed in 2008, there were already signs the industry was changing dramatically. Innovations in gas extraction, such as hydraulic fracturing or fracking and horizontal drilling, created an abundance of natural gas here in the U.S. Suki says no one realized how fast the shale gas revolution was happening.
By 2009, at the beginning of the year, people were still confused. By the middle of the year, people were pretty much convinced that we weren't going to import. And by the end of the year, we had become convinced that we actually had a shot at exporting.
Suki, a Lebanese-born entrepreneur, says it took about another year to decide whether to take a risk and start the long and expensive process to export natural gas from Sabine Pass. Guy Caruso, an energy specialist with the Center for Strategic and International Studies, says that decision was met with a huge amount of skepticism. He says at the time, natural gas prices were still high in the U.S., and it was hard to see how the costly process of liquefying and shipping the gas could actually turn a profit.
In fact, when he first mentioned that idea, some of us were wondering how he could possibly think it would work. And now he's considered to be, you know, prescient and, you know, with a great vision. And
but that risk paid off. Cheniere Energy received federal permission to export to countries that do not have a free trade agreement with the U.S., including big gas-importing countries such as China and India. In the meantime, the cost of natural gas here in the U.S. began to collapse. Suddenly, it seemed exporting LNG could turn a profit. Other companies began applying for export licenses, but by that time, the Energy Department halted any new permits. The Obama administration is weighing the environmental impact of hydraulic fracking and whether exporting LNG overseas will drive up the cost of natural gas here in the U.S. Bill Cooper, the president of the Center for Liquefied Natural Gas, says this gives Cheniere Energy a competitive edge.
Because they are under construction and nobody else is.
Cheniere CEO Suki says they're looking for customers close to home.
Starting with Puerto Rico, the Dominican Republic, Colombia, potentially Brazil, Chile, Uruguay. So you don't have to go that far. The next step geographically would be to go to Europe.
The first tanker of LNG is expected to ship out of the Sabine Pass terminal in late 2015 or early 2016. It will mark the U.S. entry into the export market for natural gas, which until now has been dominated by countries such as Qatar and Russia. Jackie Northam, NPR News.
For more international coverage, you can listen to your local NPR station. You'll find a list at our website, npr.org. And while you're there, you can find more international stories by clicking on News and World. For NPR News, I'm Ted Clark.